All right, everybody, welcome to, what episode is this of the podcast?
44.
Welcome to episode 44 of the Alexi Sale podcast.
And welcome.
Welcome indeed. And, you know, our major, I suppose the thing that we did over the new year, of course, was that I rented the Equalizer 3 on Netflix or whatever. Oh. And because we were talking before, we were talking about Ice Cube, and we were both singing along to It Was a Good Day. The TV series is, there's a TV series of The Equalizer. It stars Queen Latifah. Mm.
Funny you should mention this, because I was just thinking about this exact thing. Me and my girlfriend have been listening to Queen Latifah's 1989 album, Hail to the Queen or something like that.
Right.
It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Album. And my girlfriend doesn't know much about Queen Latifah, so we were looking her up and Googling. And then I saw that she was in
the
TV series of this. So she's learned Kung Fu to do this.
Yeah. If I'm honest, it's quite a... quite a hefty black lady, and they're like, "Oh, you're the finest." Everything on the internet is, everything on the streaming platforms is. He was a special forces.
Yeah.
Op. He wanted to retire, but he wouldn't let them.
Trying to live a happy family life now,
and they drag him back in. But Queen Latifah is part of that. But she doesn't look like a. You know, I hope I'm not being like objectionable in this, but she's not really convinced as ex-special forces.
I'll tell you what, she doesn't look like what they've told us they should look like, because it's always meant to be Denzel or Schwarzenegger or John Cena, you know, like a big hulking. Denzel isn't a big hulking man, but it normally is someone who's like barely fitting into their business suit, trying to live their normal life, and you can tell that they're a bodybuilder, you know. So it's.
I find it hard to believe in Queen Latifah. I mean, you know,
she's like. Well, I think that's the point of Equalizer, isn't it? They're like late 50s, kind of retirement age almost.
Yeah.
Being dragged back into it. But yeah, she doesn't. She's never been an action star. I think that's where it comes from as well. No. When she did her movie career, it was like rom coms and. Black comedies and
interesting casting. Whereas Denzel is starting.
What? Sorry to interrupt you. Did you watch the series?
A little bit, yeah. I couldn't really get on board with it, if I'm honest.
Okay.
But of course, Ice Cube is in two of the greatest movies ever made, which is 21 Jump Street and the follow up 22 Jump Street. Which, if you know,
he's like the angry. Police boss,
yeah,
isn't he?
The angry police chief. Boss, yeah. But those are two of the nicest films of all time, really. We can maybe talk about 21 Jump Street and then 22 Jump Street at a later date.
But the shit you say, Alexi, really throws me off guard, man.
But then The Equalizer 3, so he's finally, I think, found, he's ended up, Denzel has ended up in this Italian town called Altimonte, and he's finally found peace amongst these people.
Oh.
And a young waitress takes him to say, "So I will come in and show you real Italian food." And so she takes him down on the beach, and he's eating like, I don't know, seafood and stuff. But then he comes to a store which has got like a big doner kebab and one of those, like, you know, electronic, you know, like a kind of a thing where they shave it, you know, with like a thing. Gives him some of that, and he says, "Wow, that's delicious. What's that?" And she says, "It's called a kebab." I'm like, "What the? That's a fucking real Italian food. A fucking kebab."
And they're not being ironic about it.
I don't know what the hell was going on, because they don't, by and large, American movies these days aren't that culturally tone deaf. So I don't know whether it was a joke or it's called a kebab. I'm like, what the fuck?
Maybe that's commentary on the rise in immigration in southern Europe.
Yeah, because a lot of the goodies are not really referred to, but all the goodies are Syrian immigrants or somewhere from
The goodies.
Cool. Sort of background. Nice people in cafes all have like sort of Arabic names.
I'll take that win, man. I'll take that as an Arab. Yeah. I loved in the first Avengers movie, the last thing I was expecting is at the end of the film, if you watch after the credits, they all go for a shawarma.
Oh, really?
You've got all the Avengers sitting in a shawarma restaurant. And I'm like, okay, they go to an Arab restaurant in the Avengers and enjoy it. They're not like making fun of it or anything. I'm like, okay, fuck yeah. They could have done anything. They were trying to do is, because it's in New York, they do the big battle in New York. And they're like, let's do something stereotypically New York. And they could have done anything. They could have gone for a bagel, pizza.
Yeah.
And they chose the most popular Arab dish, which around the world, and the Germans tried to claim. You seen that German doner kebab restaurant?
Yeah, I have. What's that all about? I don't know what that's.
Because I think there's an old tradition of Turkish immigrants in Germany,
and that's. Yeah,
but it's pretty decent kebab. But now it's a chain. It's gone.
It's not. Anyway, the Equalizer 3 is.
Yeah,
it's not. You know, it's not the Equalizer 1 is the best, really.
I just saw that for the first time recently. And it was great. Quick recommendation, because, like, you know, John Wick was so popular, Equalizer was popular, mm-hmm. that kind of like ex special ops being dragged back into it, revenge, one man army style film. Yeah. I saw Bob Odenkirk's one called Nobody. Have you seen that?
Yes.
I was just shocked at how good it was. Better than the John Wick films, if you ask me.
It's like, the same people, isn't it? I think.
I think it was like the fight choreographer from John Wick.
Right.
Made it. But I think it's so creative. The action scenes are really creative. And there's a slice of humor impressive. In it as well.
Yeah. It's weird. You know, it's weird seeing an ex-stand-up comic playing one of those roles. So that...
I think they're Breaking Bad and Never Call Saul train.
Yeah, it's an interesting direction for him.
Has Peter Capaldi ever done one? That would be good to see.
He's in, Suicide Squad, follow up to,
but he's not, he's like the brains of, he's a villain.
Never done an action hero.
I'd love to see him do
physical of people.
They'd give him 6 months of combat training.
Yeah.
Do a one-man army Peter Capaldi film set in Glasgow.
Could be.
Maybe fighting hooligans or something.
Yeah.
Some hooligans, like, bully his mum and he does revenge and he beats up, like, the Millwall fans that are visiting Glasgow or something.
All right. I'll pitch it to him when we next see him.
He's such a gentle man, though.
Yeah.
I bring him up, of course, because that was our last episode.
Yeah. How much of this stuff do you think people will put up with before, you know, we get to the nitty gritty of these podcasts?
We've given it to them for free, Alexi. That's true. Yeah. And I think it's...
That's true. I keep forgetting that.
In this day and age, content for content's sake is all that matters. Just really? Give them something that they can plug in their ears and wash their dishes. And that's a gift. Isn't it?
Fair enough.
You're trying to shuffle.
No.
I was trying to segue into.
I'm sorry, you were. It was a beautiful segue. It was a beautiful
segue. Capaldi episode has gone down a treat. It was very nice. Sorry to interrupt the flow of Capaldi with this non-Capaldi episode. But why are we doing this Jacqueline Rose episode?
We thought because it's about. Well, first of all, before we deal with that, we should talk about our video on Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
Which got over 5 million views, I think, and still
across various chugging platforms. Along
across various platforms,
came out really nice, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and maybe we should think about doing more video content in the future. I don't know. So I don't want to try and... I mean, it was a one-off, and it was, you know, something that struck... It's about, obviously, a terrible... I mean, I was so offended when I heard that Stephen was doing that broadcast, and so that was my response, really, and people can go and watch it, but it was I did it, and like there's no subscribe or Patreon or any of that. It's just, you know, it's done for the sake of it,
and it was most successful piece of media that we've made
by a million miles.
Well, just in case some of the listeners don't know what we're talking about, Christmas message happens every year from whoever's the reigning royal. And then Channel 4 does the alternative Christmas message. Mm. This year it was Stephen Fry with a focus on the rise of anti-Semitism, which none of us are denying is a serious issue. Anti-Semitism is very serious and it's a bad thing. But obviously the context in which he's doing it is as a reaction to what's happening in Gaza right now.
Yeah.
Alexei decided he wanted to do an alternative Christmas message. So if you find our YouTube channel, you can watch it there. And we did it all in one take, apart from the Wilf bit, which we had to take
a
second.
Bit of a prima donna, wasn't he?
There's like, a little bit of
cheeky
editing in there. So we had to get Wilf out.
It's funny how we did. Linda runs across the camera at the end, going, "That's enough. That's enough. He's not doing another one." He's had enough. Leave
him. She was his PA, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was the animal wrangler. But,
she was representing Peter. Yeah, she was very careful that we don't distress Wilf. We got what we needed from him, though. I think we got quite lucky with the shot we needed. And that came out on Christmas Day, and it was really, really successful. We thank everyone who watched it. We probably got some new listeners listening to this right now. Welcome to the team. Yeah, it was a really quick turnaround. Came out nice. And you want to do more video stuff, but you mentioned at the beginning that you don't normally like to be too overtly political.
Yeah. I don't know, it's just, no, well, not that I don't mind being overtly political, but I think, you know, as I say, because this is, you know, this is a sort of hybrid in a way.
Yeah.
But, you know, generally speaking, I eschew making speeches or political statements. I think the job of a comedian is to make comedy, really.
Yeah. So what kind of video content do you
We'll have a think about it and see what. Maybe the listeners would like to let us know what they think and what they think would be the.
I was going to ask, if you have any ideas at home for things that Alexei can do, or email alexisalepodcast@gmail.com. Let us know there. Or if you're a member of the Patreon, patreon.com/alexisalepodcast, you can message us on there. Give us ideas. And if we like them, maybe...
maybe we'll do it, yeah. I mean, say it was a unique set of circumstances. It was a response to his dreadful message, and it was very nicely judged. You made it look lovely, and it just all worked really. So I wouldn't like to try and dive in and necessarily try and capitalize on that, but
fun silly stuff, or maybe some more slow TV and bleak dreary stuff like the bike rides.
There was an interview in the Guardian with a comedian called Jeff Innocent, who I then subsequently saw at a funeral. He was quite old, but he just said that I was the only comedian that he really respected, which thank you, Jeff. But he's also a huge hit on Instagram now. He gets like 10 million views.
Is he the bald guy with the earring?
Yes.
I love him.
Oh, I'd like to see what he does really and know how he does it, and I'd like to get that. I mean, I've done a few benefits with him and stuff.
I'll have a look at his. I've never seen his Instagram. I'll have a look at that.
But he was very nice.
I've done a gig with him.
And then there was a funeral of a comedian called Tony Allen last week that I was at, and he was there. I didn't get a chance to talk to him though.
So Christmas and New Year's was very eventful in Gaza, even more than what we've seen the last few months. Murder and horrid circumstances. Mm. And about a week before Christmas, you sat down with an amazing woman called Jacqueline Rose, psychoanalytic psychotherapist, lecturer, professor at University?
Birkbeck. Part of the University of London.
And we thought it was so prescient that we would interrupt the Capaldi stream.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And put this out today.
Yeah, seems more, you know. Listen to the interview, really. It's quite a free-ranging discussion, but it was, as I say in the interview, I read an article she'd written in the London Review of Books about the psychology of the victim, really, with reference to Israel, the this permanent sense of that Israel is always a victim, and therefore it can do what it likes, really. And
yeah, that's all described in the interview. So it was really wonderful. I hope you like it at home. And the next episode we will put out will be the second part of Capaldi's chat. Oh, and you might notice for like the first half of the interview, there's like a weird clanging noise.
It's her bracelets. Yeah.
She was wearing these bangles. Yeah. I intervened and got her to take them off. So sorry about that clickety clacking.
I don't think, I mean,
it does cease eventually.
Yeah. So this is my interview with Professor Jacqueline Rose, which was recorded just before Christmas. I'm here with Professor Jacqueline Rose, of Head of Humanities at Birkbeck. Got that right. I was prompted to contact Jacqueline after I read an article she'd written in the London Review of Books about the psych. It's called You Made Me Do It, and it's kind of about this current crisis, the kind of the assault on Gaza, and the kind of psychological component, I think, if I've got that right, really, of the aggressor, really, the Israeli armed forces. And it was, there's a kind of Freudian analysis, psychoanalytical.
There's always a psychoanalytic streak in everything I do.
Right.
So there's that undercurrent to it, yes.
Yeah. And it's, I suppose in general, I was just, searching for explanations and searching for a way forward. One of the things that I have been trying to, one of the things that seems to me that's often ignored in left thinking is that we think in these kind of strategic, kind of rigid terms of economics and class, but we never quite addressed the idea that everything springs from our psychologies, doesn't it? I mean, it's a statement that everything human beings do springs from the way they think, really. And I wonder if by looking at the kind of psychology of the oppressor and the oppressed, whether that can lead us forward in a sense. So, I mean, I guess we'd start there. So, I mean, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's the hope, that it can lead us forwards. But I think the appeal to psychoanalysis in relationship to the Middle East and conflict and Palestine-Israel is also fueled by the feeling that this is one of the most intractable conflicts of modern times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the occupation has now been going on for more than half a century. And the founding of the State of Israel was, of course, part of the struggle for self-determination of a persecuted minority and stateless minority, the Jewish people. But it was also an act of colonial settlerism and a huge displacement of an indigenous population, which represented an injustice towards another people. So Edward Said would always say the Palestinians are the victims of the victims.
Right.
Which was one of his many neat formulae. And what that seems to have produced is a situation in which it's very, very hard for the most powerful player in this game, which is Israel, to acknowledge itself as ever as being the origins of its own violence. Because a persecuted people find themselves in a land, or go to a land, on the basis of the myth, a land without a people for a people without a land, which of course was nonsense because it was completely peopled. but nonetheless, their founding mythography and history of what they've lived through is that they are the persecuted people. And therefore, the way they write the story is always that somebody else is the origins of their own violence. And that's a key part of psychoanalytic thinking. Where does guilt come from? Where does shame come from? Where does aggression come from? Why are we devoted to these things? Why do they get idealized? And why do they get denied? I guess that's a key question. Nobody wants to think of themselves as the origins of their own violence. And I've been very, very struck by this. I mean, there's one point in the article where I quote Golda Meir saying, "We will forgive the Arabs for killing our sons, but what we will never do is forgive them for making us kill their sons."
Extraordinary.
And I think that's one of the most extraordinary quotations to come out of the conflict.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you made me do it.
Yeah.
And you know, that little, you made me do it, I just landed in the article right at the end. I suddenly thought, this is playground stuff. You made me do it. And the paper made it the title of the piece, as if that was the formula that went to the heart of what I was talking about. Now, it has very serious repercussions, because if you feel you're never the origin of your own violence, then you're always the victim. You're always the one who suffers. And there's this amazing woman writer, Israeli, I don't know if you've ever come across her, called Shulamit Haraven. She was incredible. She was involved in the war of 1948, the Nakba for the Palestinians, the War of Independence for the Israelis. And so she was deeply involved in the apparatus of the state. But she wrote a short story called, the title's gone out of my head for the moment. She wrote a short story, I think it might have been called The Promise, which was about how Israel sort of suppressed what was happening in order to found a generation of strong, agile, masculine, new Jews who would rule this new land. And had absolutely full entitlement to it in certain ways, and how entrenched that became. And then in the 1980s, she wrote an article called Identity Victim. And she says things which anybody outside Israel saying would be absolutely lambasted for saying. So she says things, and she's a Jewish Israeli woman. She says, if my identity is always a victim, then it licenses any atrocity.
Right.
Now, to use the word atrocity to describe Zionist self-affirmation, as I say, if anybody said this in America or here right now, that would be seen as hate speech, incitement to racial hatred, anti-Semitism. She is analyzing her own country, and she's grieving for it.
Right. I guess where do we go from there, really? I mean, it isn't though that also, I mean, to go to a more kind of materialistic geopolitics, that Israel's self-pity or victimhood has been licensed by the, you know, larger powers and the United States for their own economic and geopolitical reasons. Yes. I mean, which is a kind of, which makes us think worse in a sense. I don't know. I mean,
it's so difficult because the materialist argument, which is that, I mean, that Britain supported the Balfour Declaration and the US after 67 flooded support into Israel. And Moshe Dayan, they were saying after the 67 war, we need him to come and fight in Vietnam. I mean, he became a hero of the American people. But basically that sort of support from America, which was really to have an outpost in the Middle East. It was entirely self-interested. And they've been unswerving in their support, including Barack Obama.
Unswerving. Yes,
absolutely. He blinked first with Netanyahu. He said he was going to cut funds if the settlement building continued, and it continued at the most extraordinary speed and pace. So it's a mixture, and I really think it's important to say this, that you can have a materialist explanation, which is that this was in the geopolitical and oil-based interests of the Western powers, and they needed a toehold in the Middle East.
Yes.
One, you can say it was the result of stateless persecution of the Jewish people, and two, and three, it was a form of settler colonialism.
Right.
And I think you have to somehow say all of them. And one of the things I was saying in my article is it's really hard to say the Jews had a movement for national self-determination. They also were in flight from persecution. Therefore, when they flooded into Palestine at the turn of the century after the Komensky massacre, and when they flooded in after the rise to power of Hitler, they were the kind of migrant, persecuted, refugee people whose entry into Britain I, and I'm sure you, support against the racist migration policies of the present Conservative government and long before. So you find yourself in this awkward position where you want to acknowledge the persecution that led to the flight, but what you're opposing is the constitution of an ethnic-based nation state, right? So you somehow have to put two hats on at once, and you're constantly being told you can't have it both ways.
Yes.
You've got to say one or the other.
Yes.
And I think most of what I've written about the Middle East conflict is an attempt to say no. And this is the psychotic point. Hold in your mind more than one thing at once, even if they contradict each other.
Right.
It doesn't matter. They can both be true. So I just think the Middle East presents us with some very difficult mental quandaries, and it's so easy to opt for the clear one-sided solution. And you've actually got to nuance it a bit. Although some people would say I'm already off the board in terms of introducing a level of subtlety, which doesn't help. Because in another way, this situation is very simple. There must be justice for the Palestinian people. Mm. That's, in a sense, all you need to say. But then you have to say, and why isn't there?
Right.
And what is this about? And why does it not move? And Ilan Pappe, who was actually Edward Said's favorite of the new historians, I'm sure you know his work.
Yes.
I remember going to a talk of his about more than 5 years ago in London. And he and Gideon Levy, the incredible left-wing journalist, Israeli journalist, was also on the platform. And Ilan Pappe just said very quietly, one thing we know. In 5 years' time, the situation of the Palestinians will be worse than it is today. And 5 years down the line after that, it'll be worse again. And it was like prophetic, right? Yes. Look what we're seeing now. So there's something, I wouldn't claim to fully understand it.
Right.
Of course, you can mobilize things like Freud's concept of the death drive. So Hannah Arendt wrote a brilliant article in the 1930s about the suicidal impulse of early Zionism. That it was attached to a myth of conflagration, destruction, apocalypse, messianism, and this great dramaturgy of the Jewish people meant they were eternal, again, eternal victims, always right. in danger, always under threat.
Right.
So we have to somehow put into here not just the fierce survival ethic of the Jewish people, which I think deserves all the credit it can get, but also a kind of will to survive at any price, which means that the people of Palestine become completely dispensable. And I think that's one of the most horrible things that we're watching at the moment.
Mm.
And I can't remember which ghastly minister it was who described the Palestinians as human animals.
It was one of the defense ministers, Gallant.
I think he may have been. And I was just thinking, but that's what we all are.
Yes.
You know, I mean, wait a minute. Your problem is that you can't see that that's what you are.
Yeah.
You know, or you call them the scum of the earth, the Palestinians.
Yeah.
Well, you're not giving them water.
Yeah.
You're turning them into the scum of the earth. Yeah. It's you who's doing it. So there's this process of swapping, of agency moving around and nobody quite taking it, certainly not the Israelis. And in the article, I talked about the wonderful psychoanalyst Leslie Sohn, who said, if you want to understand how violence works, he told me the story of sitting on a bus.
Right.
And two little boys with their mother. And the older boy hit the younger boy. And when she said, stop that, he said, but he started it. And it was a complete lie.
Yeah.
It was a complete and utter lie. And what mattered to him was not who'd hit hardest, not who had the power, but who was innocent and who was guilty.
Right.
So there's something going on there which I wouldn't even suggest I've begun to unravel.
I mean, it's worth, you mentioned Hannah Arendt just before, that there's also, it's particularly germane this week because there was a, I think she's a Russian-Jewish writer who talked about the Holocaust and how we're not allowed to compare it to anything else, who won the Hannah Arendt Prize this week. And had it revoked. Had it withdrawn.
But I don't think he said the Holocaust.
She
Oh, no, there was a man who also had the prize.
This was a woman. I don't know.
Okay, because there's been two prizes I'm aware of. One is, I've forgotten his name, but he had it revoked because he compared what's happening in Gaza now to the ghettos.
That was
a separate
one. Yes.
No, and then there's also been Adanya Shibli's amazing book, Minor Detail, whose Goethe Prize or whatever prize it was revoked at the Frankfurt Fair, although they're insisting they will give it to her later.
Right.
But and Anya Shibley's book, which is published by Fitzcarraldo, is an extraordinary narrating of the rape of a Bedouin girl during the period of the founding of Israel as a nation state. And people were just saying, we can't have this at the moment. We cannot describe
if not Israel now, when, that, really. Yeah. Now.
Although what we must talk about, of course, is Hamas's sexual violence. And I find myself agreeing that those acts of sexual violence have been sidelined. But at the same time, I don't want that to be something you then say, this shows that Hamas are human animals, which we all are. And Israel it's a whitewash of Israel. Yeah. They become this pure, non-belligerent people, which is just not.
The Guardian has been, very hot and cold on this whole issue, really. And, I have a lot of problems with the Guardian. But there's a very good piece today pointing out that Hannah Arendt would be denied the Hannah Arendt Prize because of her own writing, which was she was massively critical of Israel.
And yet she called herself a Zionist, and really? She was put in a camp at Gurs in France, and then she was in Paris or the other way around, and she was actually helping Parisian Jews emigrate to Palestine.
Yeah.
And that's why her turnaround is so incredible, because by the 1940s she's saying this is a disaster. And you're sitting yourself up in a sea of hostile Arab nations. You will be completely dependent on a foreign power in the United States of America. And to be stuck surrounded by hostile nations, totally dependent on the power of a foreign nation, is going to turn your whole country into a military security-based endeavor and destroy any other culture. She was so prescient about that.
Yeah.
And she also said something which was so astounding, which was there is a view, which many people say the Hamas attack is a continuation of, which is that the Jews cannot survive without their nation state, although those Jews did survive within it, the ones who were killed by Hamas, right?
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a problem, that argument. And that there's an eternal anti-Semitism of which Jews are always the victims. And she would say, you must distinguish between medieval Jew hatred and scientific racist anti-Semitism. If you make it one long continuum, then first of all, it's always the same thing.
Mm.
And secondly, there's no cure because it's eternal. And she said, talking about the Holocaust, she said, the fact that the events which are worse than a nightmare that have just unfolded seem to confirm Theodor Herzl's view that we are surrounded by an eternal sea of hatred does not make it true. It just makes it more dangerous.
Right.
And I think that's one of her best moments, because she's really going to the heart of how a way of thinking can really set you down a path of misery and political disaster.
Do you think in a way that the Israelis themselves are victims of this, that they don't suffer in the same way as obviously the people of Gaza, but I think, isn't it being that crazy like a terrible thing to be Mark Regev? Isn't that just the most awful thing to be, what? Mark
Regev? I don't want to call them any crazier than anybody else, because I think everybody's more or less crazy. And what's the alternative, I always say, is being normal, which the whole of psychoanalysis says will drive you crazy. So I don't want to castigate one whole side of this as crazy. But last night on television, when the woman spoke from the church, or spoke about the Liberal MP who spoke about her.
Leila Moran,
yes, she talked about, I think she's got her son and his wife, and their 11-year-old twins are in the church.
Yeah.
And they were describing snipers taking out some of the women just crossing across the square. And then they had an Israeli spokesman.
It was Regev,
No, it wasn't Regev.
Well, it wasn't Regev.
No, but he did say this is like blood libel.
Really?
He said, this is a blood libel. We have not done that. So Kristen Guru Murphy just said, are you saying this is lies? She said, this is total lies. No Israeli soldier would ever snipe at a woman walking across the forecourt. This is just not possible. This is all lies. So they couldn't have a conversation.
Right.
I mean, and it's... it was.
And what do you think is going on there then? Do you think that on one level that Israel, I mean, because clearly he is lying, does he believe his own lies? Well,
that's what you saying, what's going on and are they partly the victims? Yeah. I think they, well, we can't call it. I mean, it's a really brilliant question because you never know whether people know whether they're lying or not. Right.
Yeah.
There's a famous paradox, the Cretan paradox, I am a liar. Right. If it's true you're a liar, then you just haven't lied, so you're not a liar. There's no way you can make that sentence, I am a liar, come out syntactically or in any way meaningful whatsoever. So whether they know they're lying or not is something you can never answer on behalf of anybody else, I think.
Right.
But that they, there is a way of thinking that is the only way for them to survive given what they're doing.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, self-defense is, it's arguable whether you have self-defense in this way as a right under humanitarian law if you are an occupying people.
Yeah.
It's actually disputable. But never mind that they have the right to self-defense, let's say that. But nonetheless, it's as if there is a collective ethos of never again. We have to fight. We are the only people who can save ourselves. We have a right, therefore, to do what we want, even though a huge swathe of the world is now saying, pause, stop. This has gone beyond the pale. And they think, no, the more you say that, the more it proves that we're right to carry on exactly down the path we're going down. Well, there's a kind of internal obduracy about that, which you have to stop and ask, where are the pressure points? Now, this is where being a Freudian really comes in useful, because Freud always believes that the symptom, which is a false solution to a real psychic problem, the symptom is too costly. It uses up too much energy, and there's always a chink in the wall, which could be the dream or slips of the tongue or jokes. There are always systems at work which are cracking the edifice of what you think is your completely assured control of the world and of yourself, right, which is a lie for psychoanalysis. So this is where psychoanalysis is on the side of hope, because it says in the end this will be too expensive internally, and it will be, and it will also fail, because it's based on something so precarious and so obdurate at the same time that it's unsustainable. I'm not sure about that though, given this has been going on for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what. I wouldn't want to be give the impression that I'm suggesting psychoanalysis tells us there really is hope at the moment.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a very miserable time.
So what, I mean, what can we do?
What can we do? Well, yeah. I always say my plea is for a more psychoanalytically attuned.
Can we get
world.
Them in one by one for therapy? Start with Regev or Netanyahu. I mean, Netanyahu. What a fucking basket case. What I mean, where do you? I mean, is this too kind of tabloid? What do you think's wrong with somebody like Regev? With Netanyahu, for instance, can you think?
Well, I wouldn't want to say what's wrong with them because I don't feel I have the authority to say that. But I did in my book on Zionism, The Question of Zion, I did talk about things like Chaim Weizmann, the first president of Israel. He did say, we are completely crazy. If we weren't, we would stay in place like any normal person.
Yeah.
And wouldn't go off cavorting into the Holy Land. You know, there's something completely deranged about the whole thing.
Yeah.
Theodor Herzl, who was the founder of political Zionism, was on the verge of a nervous breakdown and all for a long time. And also wrote his most famous pamphlet, The Jewish State, or the Judenstaat, the state of the Jews, or the Jewish state. It's very hard to translate it. He wrote it in a state of kind of sort of frenzied fever and mental distress, as if they knew what they were doing was sort of impossible.
Right.
But they were so up against it, that's what they felt they had to do. So to that extent, if you bring in Hannah Arendt, Martin Buber, Hans Kohn, Ahad Ra'am, these are all the Jewish thinkers who felt that Herzl was wrong and that he was heading for a solution which was going to generate the aggression from which they were fleeing. Then if you sort of think of it as a kind of collective dream, which you can understand the reasons for, but it got locked into its own inner landscape, and then couldn't be flexible in the ways it needed to be. The tragedy is, or one of the many tragedies of the situation is, the Jews had to flee Europe because of Germanic nationalism.
Absolutely.
Based on land, faith, blood, ethnicity. They head off to the Middle East and they create a nation state based on land, ethnicity, nation, and race. So they have imported into the Middle East the very thing which they had to flee from.
Yes.
And but of course, they can't see that. It's very hard to see that.
I mean, I also think, you know, it's shocking how supportive, you know, the German state is of Israel. And but of course, it lets them off the hook, doesn't it? It lets them off the hook for the Holocaust. They haven't lost their land. The Austrians haven't lost their lands. The Ukrainians, the Poles, they didn't lose their lands. It's poor bloody Palestinians who are innocent who've paid the price, really, for the Holocaust.
That's why many Palestinians say, why did we pay that price?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Have you been reading Susan Neiman's amazing... Oh, Susan Neiman's a very remarkable German Jewish philosopher who wrote a book saying that in terms of memorializing of past crimes, Germany, in its culture of remembrance, has been way ahead of, say, the UK, where Rose Must Fall and the throwing of the Coulson statue and everything, you know, they were all sent, taken to court, those kids, and most of them got off. But now there's a new protest law which would make that kind of activity, I'm pretty sure, impossible, more or less. Well, certainly there's been a clampdown on peaceful political protests, right? Yeah. And so she was saying Germany is way ahead. It really believes in the necessity of historic remembrance because of Nazism, because of the Holocaust. And then she wrote a piece in the New York Review of Books a few issues back where she said, Germany has got itself caught in a quagmire where their support of Israel because of their guilt about what happened is so fervent that it is leading to a complete suppression of freedom of speech about what Israel itself is doing. And so the Knesset passed, it's not a law, but it passed something which made support for BDS more or less illegal.
Not the Knesset,
illegal.
But the Reichstag.
The Reichstag, sorry. Yeah, of course, not the Knesset. Yeah, sorry. Of course, the Reichstag. And Camilla Shamsi, she was meant to be given a prize Germany, and her prize was revoked because she was outspoken in her support for BDS. So the criminalizing of BDS support is one thing. And the other thing is the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, right? Which is, to say the least, problematic.
Absolutely.
And it's been rather wonderful to watch the intensity of response to that. So the Jerusalem Declaration of Anti-Semitism is much more progressive.
Indeed.
A couple of institutions have agreed to hold them both in suspense. UCL did for a while, but then let it lapse. There's been immense struggles all across the university sector not to give the IHRA binding powers over what it is possible to say. But I've forgotten who our Minister of Education was at the time.
Gavin Williamson.
Yes.
Yes.
He wrote to universities saying, if you do not adopt this definition, you will suffer financial consequences.
Yeah.
And in Germany, it's worse than anywhere else.
Yeah.
So Susan Neiman watching, it's as if there's like a split second where the acknowledgement and remembrance of your own sins as a nation state can hold the fort and be something that you pause with and go into and look at, to something that turns into a campaign against freedom of speech. I mean, the speed with which that's happened, I think, makes it very clear just how painful and costly it is for nations to remember. And not for nothing did the Coulson statue and Black Lives Matter unleash a torrent and rage against what was mostly peaceful protest.
Yes.
An absolute torrent of rage. And that was because behind it, as many right-wing politicians will say, there is an ethos of shame.
Yes.
Whereas, in fact, we should be proud of our country. Well, no, actually. You know, people sometimes say to me, you know, Chomsky once said to me, you're either a self-hating Jew or you're an anti-Semite. He said, basically, that covers the whole field, right? That covers it. Nobody's spared in that description. And people sometimes accuse me of being a self-hating Jew. And I will say, what kind of Jew do you want me to be? And then I normally say, how many parents are there in this room? I said, with your parent, you know perfectly well that there are times when it is totally appropriate to hate yourself, because we all fuck up all the time with our kids, right? Not all the time, but a lot of the time, right? And then I tell them, again, it's a Hannah Arendt story where she doesn't name her, but she's in conversation with Golda Meir, as we now know. And Golda Meir said to her, I used to love God, but now I love the Jewish people. And Hannah Arendt says, because Sholem accused her of not loving herself as a Jew. She said, I'm a Jew. That's what I am. It's not a question of loving or hating myself as a Jew. It's a fact. It's unavoidable. It's who I am. So she said, the Jewish people used to love God such that their love was greater than their fear. Now they love only themselves. What good can come out of that? And I think that's a beautiful, beautiful phrase.
It's amazing.
So I think, you know, if you're Jewish today and you're watching this state speak in your name and seeing what it's doing, then it's totally appropriate to feel certainly revulsion, horror, despair. It's nothing that's going on today can make anybody surely proud to have the state speak in their name. Shulam Mitter-Raven also used to say there's this amazing tradition of Jewish righteousness. There's this incredible tradition of justice and equity and fairness. And when we founded Independent Jewish Voices in 2007, we said that's the tradition of Jewishness we want to draw on, so that we stop putting the powers of an occupying power over the rights of a dispossessed people. And now there are many groups like Independent Jewish Voices. There was already Jews for Justice for Palestinians. I bet you remember.
I am.
Yeah. And Independent Jewish Voices. Now there's Yachad and Namod and oh, amazingly, Jewish Voice for Peace in America.
Yes.
They shut down Grand Central Station. Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know it's difficult. What do you, I mean, does your Freudianism give you any insights into the future then? What's going to happen? Professor.
Oh, gosh, that's not fair. I mean, no, Freud was serious. A pessimist. I mean, at the end of his life, I mean, he died just a few weeks after the outbreak of the Second World War. He'd left several of his sisters in Austria. He didn't believe till the very last minute that the Anschluss was coming. He stayed and stayed and stayed. He got out only because Marie Bonaparte helped him get out of Austria. And by the end of his life, I mean, in the book The Plague, I have an essay about the death of his favorite daughter in the Spanish flu.
Yes.
And he does say at one point, the experiment has failed.
Yes.
It'll have to be tried again with a different species.
Yes. I mean, you do feel that. Well, some days you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast with various people who have, you know, difficulty getting up in the morning at the moment. Lost faith in humanity. And, you know, that, I mean, you sort of, I know you read your book about the plague and about the coronavirus. You did, I mean, even before this nightmare, you sort of thought, well, it wouldn't be a bad idea if it kind of carried us all off, really.
I don't think I said that.
No, I'm saying that.
I have two very divided feelings. I mean, Rebecca Solnit has written about this. She always writes from the position of what is emerging that's good out of what is bad.
Okay.
And I certainly think that alongside the femicide, which shot up during the coronavirus epidemic, alongside the increased violence against women, which we could talk about, there was also a new respect for the ethos of care, which is classically associated with women. And there have been movements, activities, support networks, cultural creativity, commentaries, journalism, all of which I think has been illuminating and inspiring. And I think what we're talking about is political disillusionment. I mean, when you hear that COP28 hung on not phasing out, but just allowing in a just and equitable and reasonable way an eventual transmission to, i.e. nothing. And then you read the articles which say that means inside homes. It means absolutely nothing in that final statement, COP28, It means nothing about the multinationals that are actually destroying the planet. So it's not just a small achievement. It's a complete reversal and a cop-out. So at moments like that, then it's hard not to think, what is going to be the future of my newly born grandson, for example? You know, what? But I actually feel they're going to say enough. You know, I think we have to be inspired by people like Greta Thunberg. And what's so amazing about her is that she was mute for at least 2 years, I think. She just went mute.
Right.
As if this is too much. And then she found her voice as a political voice.
Right.
So I think there are reasons for optimism, which doesn't mean that the right is going to...
No.
But I think there are reasons for optimism.
There's
a reason for getting up in the morning.
Thank you for saying. One of the early Palestinian... One of the demonstration, the first one outside the Israeli embassy, somebody from the state said, you know, history told us that, you know, right shows us that right always wins in the end. And I thought, fuck no, it doesn't. History does not show us that.
Who said the arc of freedom curves, the arc of the rainbow curves towards freedom? Was that Baldwin?
I think so.
I can't remember, basically, I love that image.
Yeah.
I love that image. Well, yes and no.
Hard to believe that at the moment.
It's very hard to believe that at the moment. And what happened with women under COVID, I thought was it was incredible because I wrote a little book called Mothers, an essay on love and cruelty, in which I say mothers are asked to do the impossible. They're expected to make the world safe, happy, just, which, of course, you're a mother for 5 minutes and you know none of those things are true, but that is their edict. And, of course, they fail at it because nobody could succeed, and then men hate them for not succeeding at an impossible task.
Right.
And, of course, what women are meant to save men from is fear of their mortality, right, by their nurturance and their care and their support. And in a pandemic, nobody's mortality, nobody is safe. Death comes too close. So I felt that was why the femicide rate went up so high, because men and women were shut in their houses together, which is a license for abuse. Abusers always work from home, as that brilliant poster up in London. So it's a license for abuse, but it also the men felt they were being feminized by having to be at home.
Right.
But also, there was no way out of what was happening. It was in your face. Whereas normally what women are meant to do is make it all feel somehow okay, right? So I felt that that was horrible, but also an illusion was cracking. And that out of that, some amazing women leaders emerged, like Ahern in New Zealand and Sanna Marin in Finland. She was remarkable. And Mia Motley in Barbados. Incredible. And even up to a point, Angela Merkel on COVID, you know, up to a point because she destroyed Greece financially, right? So we'll go there. But I just felt there were real signs of, wait a minute, something is not working.
Yeah.
It's really not working, so we need some new ideas, I like to think.
Yeah, well, yeah, let's hope so. I mean, it's you do feel that. I mean, you mentioned, like, Black Lives Matter. And I mean, how prevalent, you know, they're all footballers kneeling and, you know, the statue. And then they kind of... It all went away, or they got rid of it, didn't they? They found a way to kind of negate it.
Well, I think that's the next stage of the battle.
Yeah.
That, you know, and that's why places like Liberty are so important and organizations like Liberty, because this is an ongoing battle. I'll tell you a story.
Yeah.
I was being in a conversation with Juliet Mitchell, who I did a book on Lacan with many, many years ago. And Jean Radford, who's a wonderful feminist literary critic, was in discussion with us. And she said, so what do you think have been the successes and failures of feminism over the last however many decades? And I came up with this really soppy little well-behaved answer where I said, well, it's had many great achievements like suffrage and, you know, this and that and the other. On the other hand, we weren't very good on race and different sexualities and so on and intersectionality. So we've had to catch up with that. I mean, you could fall asleep just listening to me now, right? And then she turned to Juliet Mitchell and said, what do you think have been the successes and failures of feminism? And Juliet said, it's been 100% success. And we sort of looked at her and said, what? She said, it's been 100% success, she said, because it is the longest revolution, the feminist revolution. And for every step you take forward, there will be a backlash. So it's interminable. The struggle is interminable. And I think that's something I'm realizing more and more, because when I, in the 70s, when I first came to full political consciousness, I really thought we were going to change the world for the better.
Yeah.
And we were a generation of radicals. And in my case, feminism, Marxism, and Freudianism between them were going to rule the roost.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything was going to be just fine. So there has been, I think it started with Thatcher actually, but a horrible period of disillusionment and the watching the power of repetition. Mm. Things you thought would not happen again, happening over and over and over. Again, you might want to call it capitalism, by the way. But if you take Juliet's attitude, which is, but that's part of it.
Right.
That's part of it. That sense we've been here before. And as we get older, you think we've been here before, so we just go on struggling. Yeah. And that gives me optimism.
Yeah.
Without any mythical belief that you're going to change the world and have the revolution tomorrow.
No.
Although Rosa Luxemburg is one of my favorite thinkers of all time.
Right.
She really believed in the revolution.
I did that. Well, what did she? She ended up drowned and in a canal. But
she ended up being murdered.
Yeah.
By the German police state. Yes, yeah. She did. But she had a lot to say about revolutions before that, which are irreplaceable and absolutely wonderful.
Well, maybe that is all that we can take, really, is it just goes on, doesn't it, really? You have to, you know, it's like the kind of closing line of the closing paragraph of The Great Gatsby, you know, like ships beating on in the night or whatever it is. That's all we can do, really.
Well, one of Freud's famous essays is called Analysis Terminable and Interminable, which actually in the German is closer to Analysis Finite and Infinite. And what he's saying is the process of analysis, you don't one day wake up and decide you're cured. You have to go on with the work, and you go on with it for the rest of your life if it's going to make any difference. It can be you internally doing it after you've had your 20 years on the couch or whatever it is you've had.
Some guy,
at a huge cost.
Yeah.
but, yeah, it's interminable. You have to reckon with something being interminable.
Yeah.
It's not quite so desolate-making.
Yeah. No. So you are also, well, my wife did a philosophy degree at Birkbeck, so I have some connection. I don't know. I mean, tell us about your work at Birkbeck.
Okay. Well, the Institute.
And your writing. And tell us, who are you? Tell us about Jacqueline Rose.
Well, now. I can't tell you who I am because I don't know the answer to that question, but in any formulaic way. But I came to critical thought and everything that I ended up writing about through my experience as an undergraduate at Oxford, where in the course of 1 week, Germaine Greer came and gave a talk and the Black Panthers came to town.
Wow.
And Germaine Greer gave this, she wasn't known yet, she hadn't written The Female Eunuch, and she gave this incredible talk which consisted of graphics of women with threads attached to them with kind of saucepans and knitting needles and babies and all of this. And then as she was talking, a pair of scissors came and cut all the links and sort of set the woman free. At the same time, there's a guy in the audience who was very camp in his style said, don't you realize that if you carry on down this path, you're going to make a lot of women very, very unhappy? To which the answer, of course, was a lot of women are very unhappy.
Yeah.
And then I went with my friends to hear Scott of the Black Panthers speak, and somebody in the audience said, excuse me, can you tell me the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats? And Scott just said, it's all the same shit, man. All the same shit. And I felt I'd been politicized in 1 second. And then we've got together and formed a feminist group that, agitated for childcare for the women of Blackbird Leys, which was the industrial estate that had been formed by cleaning out the working class from St. Ebbs and putting them on the outskirts of Oxford. So there's a horrible history behind it. So all these things politicized me as I went through. And then the thing that really changed everything was when I started to read Freud. I was doing a maîtrise in Paris, and my supervisor said, your thesis is interdisciplinary. you must read the works of Freud. And he said, and what you must do is you must get hold of Ernest Jones's biography of Freud. You read the biography, and every time you get to work by Freud, you put the biography down and you read the work. I got through about 11 volumes.
Bloody hell.
And I felt this has changed everything. Some of the case histories of the women, like the case of Dora, I thought, this has changed everything. So then I became involved in what might be the connections between my literary history, my political experiences, and psychoanalysis. And the links between those things have formed the basis of everything I've done so far.
And the Marxism?
The Marxism came out of the clearing of the Blackbird Lees estate out from St. Ebbs, i.e. To feed the Ford factory, the Cowley work, it was Cowley,
yeah.
To feed the Cowley Works factory. Ladies, yeah. But also my Marxism came out of the fact that I was brought up in Hayes, Middlesex, which was a working class town on the edge of, it was home to the Nestle factory, so all the workers went out to the factory, and also to Southall, where Blair Peach was murdered about 30 years later, but also Southall, which had the rubber factory, which imported Asian labour because British workers couldn't tolerate the heat. That was the mythography around it. And to go to school at Ealing Grammar, we had to drive through Hayes, Middlesex, through Southall, which was Asian, through Hanwell, where there was the famous quote-unquote lunatic asylum, to Ealing Grammar. And it was as if in one fell swoop every day, we were being ferried through class and race difference and back again.
Right.
And my parents were religiously anti-racist. They were incredible. My father was a GP. My stepfather was a GP. So all this politics came flooding in for all these different directions at once. But I will just say one thing, which is I wrote a book on Sylvia Plath called The Haunting of Sylvia Plath, in which I wasn't happy with the idea that she was a victim of patriarchy and Ted Hughes, or that she was crazy. So I wanted to write a book that would find a third way and didn't see that a feminist reading meant presenting her as done in by patriarchal institutions and by Ted Hughes and so on and so forth. And then I started my work on Zionism, and I realized in a sense they were deeply connected, because in both cases, I didn't like the victim narrative.
Right.
That became a constant of my work. I didn't like the victim narrative. And what I always say is that victimhood is an event. It's something that happens to you. The moment you turn it into a psychic or political identity, you're finished.
Right.
So this has become a bit, you know, Jacques Lacan, the famous psychoanalyst, once said, je ne me répète jamais, mais je dis toujours la même chose. I do not repeat myself, but I'm always saying the same thing, which I think is fabulous.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling that might be true of me as well.
I think all of us, I mean, any great artist or great thinker in a way is true. Always of anybody,
going off on the same thing.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I also would like to mention Edward Said here, because certainly meeting him made me think not just that I should be dissatisfied with what Israel had let itself become, but I should be more activist and should be making it the center of my thinking. And he told me that I should be doing that. And it really, he didn't agree with everything I said, but he ushered me into another space and encouraged me. And it was very, very important.
Jacqueline, if the listeners would like to read some of your more recent books, what would you recommend?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so definitely The Plague, Living Death in Our Times.
I've read it. It's great. Yeah.
Which is about our response to the pandemic, mm-hmm. and our ability and inability to cope with it. And
but also about Camus, you know.
Camus, The Plague, the famous essay, yeah. The Plague.
Yeah.
And the fact that Freud's daughter died of the Spanish flu, things that people don't know. And also about the wonderful woman philosopher Simone Weil, who helped me keep my intellectual energies and my emotional energies going throughout the pandemic. So I really hope people will read that. And before that, I wrote a book called On Violence and On Violence Against Women, which came out of a feeling that I really needed to take up a subject which is a feminist I'd never really broached before. So I would love people to look at that. And then the other one that I mentioned was Mothers, an essay on love and cruelty, which is about the very weird expectations Western culture has of what a mother should be, and how self-defeating I think those expectations are. So take your pick.
Okay.
And thank you so much.
Thank you, Jacqueline, very, very much. It's been amazing. Talala, we've both been entranced. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on your program. Thank you, your podcast. Thank you.
Yeah, that was, as you said, it was amazing. You were really taken with her, weren't you?
Yeah, you don't hear me in the interview, but I was. Every now and then, you and Jacqueline would go, Talal, how's this sounding? Is it good? And I was just like enamored. She's just so great. She's so clever.
I know a lot.
She fucking knows a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
And just really good at talking and being interesting. And
yeah.
And I love all that psychoanalytics.
Yes,
stuff.
Yes.
And funnily enough, just a couple days ago, I watched a film called Israelism, which I wish I'd seen before the interview because it really ties in. I really recommend anyone at home to watch it or to get your friends to watch it. Israelism is a film about Zionism, essentially. I think it was targeted at American Zionists, people who go to Jewish schools, and they have a whole class on Israel, like once or twice a week, just from a young age, teaching them about their homeland, their birthright, and having all this drilled into them. And it really made me realize that it's this whole Zionism business is so much like a cult. It's unreal. Yeah. And a lot of people being interviewed in the film have escaped that cult. And now, you know, there's an organization called Breaking the Silence in Israel and things like that. And really, really well made, beautifully shot. And the interviews are gorgeous. It's called Israelism. We watched it on a platform called Kinema, which is like cinema, but with a K at the beginning. I think you can rent the film on there.
Okay.
And we watched it with a group of non-Jewish, non-Arab, English friends. And I was surprised that they were surprised by a lot of the stuff we saw in the film. Like, I didn't realize how, not everyone, because I guess I'm Arab, I know a lot about this situation. And my Jewish friend, who's very active in anti-Zionist activism, he knows a lot about Citrine, but a lot of our friends were like, oh my God, is that true? Oh, I didn't realize it's free to visit Israel if you're Jewish. I didn't realize they give you a house for free. Like, and I was like, yeah. Oh, that's the whole point. You didn't know that. Don't be afraid to tell your friends what you know and talk to them like as if they don't know anything, because you might be surprised. A lot of people don't.
Indeed, it's a cult of, unfortunately, a murderous one.
God, I'm talking a lot today. Sorry, listeners.
That's all right. some of them love you.
Some of them. That's true. We've heard some new music in this episode today. Thank you to my brother over at Tarbush Records. He's provided me with some new beats for 2024.
Yay.
Tarbush Records, Tarbosh. You can find them on YouTube, on SoundCloud, Mixcloud. They are two British Arab hip hop music producers who make mixes and beats and put it all out for free. Go find and support them. If you don't mind me talking a bit more, Alexi.
It's a bit late now, isn't it?
Please, it would really help our podcast. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, anywhere but Spotify, really, you can leave a review. And that really helps us spread the word and get more people listening. So just leave us a 5-star review. It would be really great. And it would be even better if you wrote a couple of sentences in the review box. Like, just say, even if you just say, Talal sent me here or whatever. But it helps the algorithm. And more than anything, of course, patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. You can put £3 a month.
Give us some money!
Support the show, help pay my bills, keep this show going, and help me dedicate more time to it. It would mean a lot.
Yes.
Thank you. Alexi, anything else to say about that lovely interview about
No, not really. I think it's all there in the interview. I did, you know, it's made me think a lot about, I would like to try and somehow incorporate some of what she said and some of what, just that, you know, the psychology of the oppressor. I would like to somehow try and incorporate it into a, you know, a kind of a political philosophy going forward, really. Talk to more people about it. Find out how we're going to stop this shit.
And, yeah, and maybe affect, change the way that we talk to Zionists, maybe. Mm. I don't know, because if we think of them in a different way, maybe we would approach it. Because we've been, I don't know, there's sometimes it seems so futile, you know.
Yeah.
You see that fucking Julia Hartley Brewer screaming at Mustafa
Barghouti
and
yeah,
calling him sexist and stuff. And
she's an odious.
She's character. Always been.
Yeah.
But that's just who we've always been dealing with, those type of people. Well, she's coming from a point of ignorance. But then, you know, people like Mark Regev and whatnot, like, how do you deal with these people? How do you talk to them? I guess understanding the psychology is one step towards.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I'm thinking about it. I'm nearly there. I've nearly got the answer, everybody. I just need a bit more. Just a couple more. Go talk to a couple more people. Yeah. Think about it more, and then I've got. I think I'm there. I'm nearly there with the answer.
Okay. All right. Well, free Palestine, everybody.
Indeed. Indeed. All right. Bye. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.